In 1894, South Australia became the second place in the world to give women the right to vote and stand in Parliament. This feat wasn't achieved overnight, but through years and years of hard work and activism. In this podcast, we'll explore the lives and stories of some of the women who made this possible. In this episode, we'll take a look at the life and work of the woman who has been described as the poster girl of the suffrage movement, Mary Lee. Warning: this episode contains discussions of mental illness and mental health. Born in Ireland in 1821, Mary Lee migrated to South Australia in 1879 to care for her sick son. Little did she know that she was arriving at quite a pivotal time for women.
There were large numbers of women who were living in very vulnerable conditions.
That's the voice of Denise George, the author of Mary Lee, The Life and Times of a Turbulent Anarchist and Her Battle for Women's Rights.
Many of the young Irish and English girls who had arrived came looking for work. Some of them either lost the jobs that they had and found themselves living on the street. Generally, women were still very reliant on the men in their lives, whether it was their fathers or their husbands or their partners.
Within a couple of years of moving to Adelaide, Mary Lee became heavily involved in a number of causes to improve the lives of women, a passion which predated her migration to Australia.
She had grown up and survived numerous famines, but she had certainly survived the Great Potato Famine, where something like a million Irish people perished. So she had sort of come in, I think, to personal contact with poverty and with the underprivileged and with the difficulties that people experience. And I think that experience generated a genuine concern for other people.
While she may be best known for spearheading the suffrage campaign, Mary Lee was also a regular visitor to the destitute and lunatics asylums. And in 1896, she was appointed as the only female visitor to the Parkside and Adelaide lunatics asylums, a position she held for 12 years, up until her death.
It was a purely voluntary position, and up until that point in time, only male politicians were asked to visit the asylum.
In those days, these asylums weren't just home to those who were in poverty or in need of psychiatric help. They were also home to people with physical disabilities and those who were poor, ill, or even pregnant.
Sometimes, of course, the families would have them institutionalised because they had become difficult to get along with. And it was often a consequence of, you know, poor behaviour, unpredictable behaviour. Sometimes they would be arrested, they would go to the jail and then be transferred to what were then known as the lunatic asylums.
As a visitor to the asylums, Mary Lee didn't really have a set role, but she took it upon herself to inspect the conditions there and argue for improvements.
Her role was to visit the asylums and to inspect what were then quite large wards. So she would speak to the doctors about the particular residents' care. She would speak to the residents, but it was mainly really inspecting the conditions. They had what they called a visitor's book, and generally the male politicians previously would do a quick round of the wards and they would sign the book, make no comment and leave. What Mary did was she would inspect quite closely these wards, inspect the conditions, and she would, in the visitor's book, record what she had found, and especially if she was concerned. For example, the Botanic Gardens was adjacent to the Adelaide Asylum, and they used to have these big burn-offs, big fires, and the smoke from the fires would fill the wards of the lunatic asylum. Of course, all the inmates and patients were almost asphyxiated from the smoke. So she would complain, and she wrote letters to the newspapers saying, like, it's not good enough, you know, these people are suffering. She would speak to politicians and say, look, you really need to do something about it. And on a number of occasions, she was ignored. So she would again write to the newspapers and again lobby the politicians and get quite cranky with them, saying, you know, you really need to do something about this.
While the focus in the 18 and 1900s was heavily on keeping mental illness out of sight and out of mind, these days, mental illness is very much in the spotlight. We have national days dedicated to talking about mental health with your mates, phone apps are available to help curb anxiety, mental health care plans are readily available through Medicare, and even Prime Minister Scott Morrison has marked lowering the suicide rate as a key area of focus.
Traditionally, we've seen it as more of a medical problem, and that's important, but it's not enough in terms of getting those results around people's lives.
That's Jeff Harris from the Mental Health Coalition of South Australia, a peak mental health body committed to making sure all South Australians experiencing mental health issues can lead good lives.
In a modern approach to mental health, one of the really important things that's happened is discussions around human rights. The results we're after in terms of people leading a good life with mental illness aren't just about the illness, they're actually about, you know, having a good life. So that's something meaningful to do. It's having good relationships, it's having good housing, education, all of those things.
But while incarceration may no longer be a response to mental illnesses and disabilities, a lot of stigma and uncertainty still remains in this field.
One of the barriers to people becoming well is issues around stigma and discrimination, including self-stigma.
While mental illness and mental health are more publicised and talked about than ever before, this hasn't necessarily led to a decrease in rates of mental illness here in Australia. According to a report by the Black Dog Institute published in 2019, the mental health of young people in Australia is actually getting worse.
People are more willing to talk about mental illness, and that will drive increasing rates. Maybe 20 years ago, they wouldn't have talked about it and wouldn't have been willing to go to a GP or some kind of doctor to talk about a mental health problem.
And while talking about mental illness may lead to more diagnoses, Kes Roblin from Uniting SA doesn't think we should discount the therapeutic effects of talking about our feelings.
So stigma is from being alone in a situation where the lens then becomes, well, maybe it's me. It never is. I'm yet to meet a person that you go, actually, yeah, it is you. It's all about not being alone.
Kes works as a coordinator of the NDIS Lived Experience Pilot at Uniting SA and thinks that in order to see progress, we need to change the way we think about mental health and how we issue blame.
A really wise friend of mine told me that when a pot plant starts to wilt, something that I have noticed is I never really get frustrated or upset with the plant. I look at 100 different things around that plant of what's going on for Mr. Planty Face. I make sure I check the water's right, make sure pH levels are right. I'll shift it around. I'll pray to the gods before I start persecuting or placing judgment that there is something wrong with that pot plant. Imagine if we could treat humans the same.
While stigma around mental health still well and truly exists, some headway has been made in improving services and support to people with mental illnesses through the expansion of the NDIS to cover people with psychosocial disabilities.
The number of people that it aims to support is quite small. They're planning to have 64,000 people nationally in the NDIS with a primary disability of psychosocial disability. And so that's a really small number. There's roughly about 695,000 people nationally who have what we term severe mental illness. And so 64,000 is a relatively small cohort of that.
But some mental health professionals are still wary of the reach and depth of this scheme and the criteria that must be met for people to receive support.
We've already lost over 1,200 incredible human beings just through the application process and waiting periods of NDIS. The first problem, if I'm putting my judgment hat on, would be that it's a system. A system has to be block-shaped or it has to be a tick box-shaped, and humans don't fit uniformly inside anything of that shape. The NDIS needed to be designed alongside with the people that it was for.
In order to be eligible for the NDIS, applicants need to prove that their mental illness results in a disability, which presents a range of problems for people with mental illnesses. In her experiences, Kes has found that it's difficult for people with complex illnesses, like schizophrenia or borderline personality disorders, to successfully apply for the NDIS.
Let's say with borderline personality disorder, that means you have had a bucket load of experiences that have brought you to a point where you have learnt to cope very differently and very uniquely as a survival mechanism. Clinicians see it as you're too hard to work with because we can't fit you in any of these defined boxes.
While the NDIS may still have some kinks and bumps to work out, a scheme like this would have been completely unimaginable 30 years ago, let alone 125 years ago. In order to ensure that everyone can be provided with the support they need, both Kes and Jeff agree that mental health services need to evolve and expand.
Where we've been in the mental health system has been just focusing on the illness and trying to minimise the symptoms. That's important, but it's not enough in terms of getting those results around people's lives. Often, when people become quite unwell, the problems accumulate. You know, you might lose your job, so then you might get financial difficulties, you might lose your housing, relationships can be problematic. So really just trying to recognise that people's lives can quickly become quite complicated and have lots of problems, but if you spend the time working with people to help them to solve problems and then to actually generate more positive things in their lives, then that's when we get, I think, a much more robust result in terms of human rights outcomes.
This podcast was proudly brought to you by SACOS, the South Australian Council of Social Service. A big thank you to the Mental Health Coalition of South Australia, Uniting SA, Denise George, and the Office for Women for making this episode possible. If this episode has brought up anything for you, know that someone is always there to listen or help. You can contact Lifeline on 131114.